All right. It's nice to be here with you today. And I am here with Allison. Allison is 10 years at the Core Center? 12 years at the Core Center, a large one-stop shop HIV infectious disease clinic in the Illinois Medical District here in Chicago. And we're joined by her colleague, Marisol Gonzalez, and a number of other colleagues from other institutions. Jason provided some statistical support over the last number of years and was from the ETAC, Arthur's group. And Jessica and Sabrina are both with HRSA from SPINS and the Office of Women's Health, respectively. And as Arthur mentioned, this work is supported by HRSA. We have no competing financial interests. And we thank all of the women who participated in the multi-site and our local evaluation and all the staff who supported them. And just as an overview, Allison's going to talk about women and HIV, intimate partner violence in HIV. We're going to talk about a very simple study that we ran and some implications, some practical and policy implications from the study.
Do you want me to switch the slide?
That's okay.
Good morning. To provide some context for women and HIV, some statistics, and this is from the CDC. So nationally, there are 242,000 women, roughly, who are living with HIV, 88% of whom are aware of their HIV status, and 45%, almost half, are engaged in care, and just 32% are virally suppressed. So in relation to IPV and HIV, what we found is that 68 to 95% of women who participated in this clinical study had experienced IPV at some point in their life. IPV is a risk as well as a consequence of HIV. So basically what that means is if somebody discloses their HIV status to their partner, it could result in violence, as well as being a significant risk factor for HIV. And so here are some examples of how that could be the case. So certainly, as Betsy discussed with substance use, and we found the same in our study for certain, and other risk factors that IPV is associated with is multiple sex partners, and certainly exchanging sex, and negotiating challenges with negotiating safer sex. So IPV is associated with poor health outcomes, physical and mental health outcomes. And certainly what we found in our study was that there were poor HIV outcomes as well. So high no-show rates to appointment. So in terms of it interfering with HIV primary medical care, also with antiretroviral treatment failure, and women having detectable viral loads, and in lower CD4 counts as well as higher opportunistic infections. So this is a snapshot of our study that we ran as part of the Special Project of National Significance Women of Color Initiative. And this is actually a subset of our study. So we, for the purpose of this presentation, we're focusing on our African American HIV positive women. So our women were, on average, were about 48 years old. Majority were single and unemployed or underemployed, mostly heterosexual, and over half were renting a house or unstably housed throughout the time of their involvement in the initiative. And likewise, in terms of income, 88% with less than $1,000 a month in income. And the same in terms of the intervention as Bethy had discussed. This was looking at the involvement from the HIV care continuum. So we were targeting women who were newly diagnosed with HIV, or they were new to care, so they could have been diagnosed many years ago but just engaging in care, and or they were could have been sporadically engaged or lost to care. So, and we define lost to care as no visits in the last 12-month period.
Allison, real quick, can you just give a brief summary of the intervention context?
Sure.
Because I think we neglected that.
Sure. So our intervention was a peer patient navigation intervention, and it was a pilot, so it was actually the first time that we were implementing that kind of intervention at the Core Center. And we had three peer patient navigators who reflected our patient population, and they worked individually with the participants to really to help them engage in care and help them remain engaged in care. And we followed people for either 18 months or until they were ultimately and optimally engaged in care. And our peer patient navigators, we have an existing peer educator program at the Core Center, so we pulled from that population when we were recruiting for these positions. And the peer patient navigators reflected our patient population. They shared many characteristics with these women, and they really worked to dispel myths about HIV and share their personal life experiences with somebody who's living with HIV. And we also had, that was our primary intervention. We also had another smaller part of the intervention we implemented a group level intervention called Healthy Relationships, which I'll talk a little bit more on later on.
And I don't think we've passed out the handouts, but we have some handouts here. We incorporated a variety of measures over time to explore.
Let me hand those out.
Okay.
Recording sessions. Your voice.
Thanks, Arthur. So we incorporated a variety of instruments over time that explored concerns related to violence. We have some baseline instruments, interview that was done at 3 months, and an acuity measure that was piloted on a 6-month basis. And so I thought we could go quickly through the first two columns of the handout. Do you guys want copies? And this is from our local evaluation. We actually had about 2/3 of our participants in a local evaluation and 1/3 in the multi-site evaluation. But as we were trying to design our local evaluation, we obviously looked at and learned from the multi-site evaluation tool, and we incorporated a couple of elements from the multi-site evaluation tool. One of the elements instruments that we incorporated was the web, women's experience with battering. We also incorporated a barrier to care question that listed a whole number of, something like 26 or so barriers that may have gotten in the way of coming into care. And one of those items was thought that partner might hurt you. So that was, if that was endorsed somewhat or a great deal, we took that as an indication that there's concerns of violence. In addition to those multi-site instruments, we incorporated some local questions that were of interest to our providers. And we incorporated just some very simple kind of ER screening questions. And then we had some interest in mode of transmission. And so we had a question that asked women to report a likely mode of transmission. And one of those was through sexual assault. And then as part of the demonstration project, TERSA really encouraged folks to create and pilot acuity measures. And one of our items on the acuity measure related to violence. And so I'm just going to, the acuity measure asked women to identify their current level of safety in their relationships. With coded responses of facing current life-threatening violence and or abuse. So three we coded as having current life-threatening violence. Two was coded as having fears of emotional, sexual, or physical safety. One was having past experience with domestic violence or abuse. And zero was coded as or having no experience with abuse was coded as zero. Sorry. So those were the variety of questions and items that we asked over time. And then if we look at the third column in the table, you can see that, you know, the third and fourth column of the table, it's very interesting that at the instrument level, you know, our instruments on their own did not do a very good job identifying women with concerns of violence. And so about 12 to 40% of the sample were identified at the individual level using these tools. But then if you look across these instruments, and if they had a positive screening on any of these components, we were able to identify 68% of the sample with concerns of violence. So quite a change. And then we looked at the relationship between concerns with violence and suppression. And overall, the core center and our linkage and retention projects experience really high suppression rates. When they get folks into care, they're doing a great job relative to suppression. So overall, we had 80% of the women suppressed, and this was using clinical data at 12 months. But when we look at how violence related to suppression, we see that those who reported a concern of violence were less likely than expected to also be suppressed. So 80% overall, but if you had a history of violence, 72% of those with a history of violence were suppressed. 96% of the women who, you know, 90% were suppressed without a history of violence. And we're going to talk just briefly about the implications to practice and policy. It's a very simple kind of study. I think the bottom line is that using a variety of tools over time allowed for rapport and disclosure and identifying women with concerns of violence. And had we just stuck with a baseline tool or, you know, maybe any one of these items or instruments, we might not have identified concerns with violence. And I think I neglected to mention, but we did look at, do these individual tools have any relationship to suppression? And it was only the composite measure that related to suppression. So Allison's going to talk a little bit more about practice implications.
Okay. So what we have been working on at the Core Center, it's really been an evolving process and continues to evolve. But it's really important to have, or at least consider and think about, having policies and procedures that can support efforts of addressing violence and certainly identifying anybody who discloses violence. What is the practice implications? What are the policies and procedures for compassionately and sensitively addressing those issues and providing support for folks who disclose either current violence or violence in the past. So providing training for any kind of providers, whether staff at any level, we have been fortunate to really since, and I should back up a little bit, during the initiative, we partnered with Schroeder Hospital for their domestic violence program. So our policy that we utilized was to make referrals to Schroeder Hospital, which is really just about a half a block away from us. So we would ask questions when we would do debriefings after our research interviews, which the peer patient navigators they conducted the research interviews, and so they would debrief on questions. If there are any kind of concerns that were conveyed during these meetings and interviews, so if anybody said that they were interested in addressing it or receiving support for any concern such as violence that they may have shared, then the peer patient navigator would provide a warm handoff to the Schroeder Domestic Violence Program. But since that time, we have partnered with SAMHSA, and we are at least 2 years into really providing a foundation of a trauma-informed care context at our facility. But having training in place and really developing capacity of really any provider at any level, starting with even the clerks at your organization, really can matter and does matter. Providing a care context really just speaks to what do you have in place for your staff to provide these services? What kind of support do you have in place? And how might disclosure be fostered? So I mentioned that our sub-intervention is an evidence-based small group behavioral intervention called Healthy Relationships. And a big component of that intervention was focused on disclosure. So there were role plays that were done in the intervention where it was a video, like of a movie, and participants in the group could press pause. So at what point in this scene would you feel comfortable disclosing your HIV status? And really the whole point was just to kind of like practice and really think through it, like how and really develop the self-efficacy in disclosing. And really having people talk through like their readiness to disclose, what could be the implications of them disclosing, and that kind of thing. And certainly screening is very important. There are guidelines with the World Health Organization that recommend universal screening and routine screening. You know, we talked about our findings with providing screening at multiple steps at multiple interviews throughout the participants' involvement, and we believe that that really made a difference in people not only asking the questions multiple times, but certainly we believe that the development of the relationship with their peer patient navigator had an effect on that as well as their comfort level to disclose. And prevention, raising awareness, and one of the things that we do at the Core Center is we have our peer educators that I mentioned go out into the community and provide awareness and education, and they do public personal testimonials. And that can certainly impact somebody's prevention and prevention of by sharing their personal story can help provide awareness to somebody who may be living with violence. And also having in place, I mean, really the policies and procedures really guide in terms of, you know, making referrals. So it's all overlapping, but if you have procedures to do screening and then you incorporate what you will do once you, if somebody discloses a history or current experience of violence, then what is the procedure thereafter? And where would you make referrals? Would you make internal referrals? And that kind of thing. So thinking through things practically and how that could translate within your organization is important.
And there are a variety of tools that have been reported in the literature to help with assessing and understanding violence. We're happy to share citations for these and encourage folks to look into them, but we also encourage you to talk with your clinicians and providers, and you know, there's almost always people who specialize and have special interests in reaching out to folks experiencing trauma in our clinical settings. And you know, what works for them? What are the kinds of questions? What are the general characteristics of the settings that really foster collaboration and trust and safety and disclosure? Some of these instruments may be re-victimizing. I mean, they're pretty involved, and so I think that's something else to keep in mind, obviously. And then in terms of policy implications, there really is a need still to provide more funding for developing interventions and then helping to translate interventions into clinical settings. We also just don't know, you know, we still need to learn more about the mechanisms underlying this relationship between trauma and HIV. There's some interesting work that's being done to look at how trauma impacts your immune system, and trauma is certainly linked to other mental health issues like depression, anxiety, PTSD that impact your care engagement. And we just really have so much more work to do to figure out what is the evidence base around interventions to support people facing violence and chronic illness. And along with funding, agencies need technical assistance to develop the clinical capacity to screen and serve, and to foster those collaborative relationships with a wide web of folks. There's lots of DV partners and mental health providers and substance abuse folks, but it's often very hard to collaborate, you know, even in our setting where you've got lots of overlapping providers. So, and that's it. So thank you very much.
Any questions?
Your sample has a very high proportion of people with unstable housing and unemployment and low educational levels. And I wondered if those things were related to intrapartner violence and what is the kind of implication of that constellation of factors.
That's a really good point. We have a we're fortunate at the Core Center that we have a lot of co-located services there. So once somebody comes in, we, you know, it's kind of like the sort of like the hierarchy of needs, right? So address really what's the most. Certainly from a client-centered perspective, what is the most pressing issue right at that moment in time that they walk through the door? We have case management that can help address the housing issue. We have mental health on site. We have chemical dependency on site. So we're very lucky, and we can link folks to those different services. And that's how we address any needs, you know, that are conveyed, certainly, because that needs to be addressed first.
And I think statistically we're still analyzing all those associations, but I think one of the takeaway messages for me, as I'm a community psychologist, not with extensive experience in the HIV world, and one of the really kind of big learning lessons for me was that HIV is really for many of these women, the least of their concerns. And oftentimes it's actually presented, they're reporting it almost as a blessing, and that they have so many issues going on in their lives, and they're finally coming together with other women for the first time in the healthy relationships intervention. It was very striking, the importance of sisterhood and these new relationships with linkage and engaging with providers in ways that they never have linked up with anyone. There's a lot of isolation. And so I think for our sample, it's urban, very low income, lots of challenges facing our women.
Thank you.
unstable housing in most analyses ends up being predictive of bad outcomes, and that isolation that Susan is just talking about, some of that's the isolation of moving around so much or being jailed for something for a short period of time or going to rehab for a short period of time, and even those things that are supposed to be helpful actually is a disincentive for and very hard to build community and social support. A lot of people in the HIV and housing world just say housing is HIV treatment.
And just to underscore some of the points that Susan and Betsy and Allison have made, in data that's not recorded here yet, still to be worked on, in the follow-up, there's a small section of the survey which asks women to identify what areas they have problems in. And that could be psychological, could be physical. But one of the options also is life circumstances. And when they once they identify these issues, they're then asked to say, well, what's the most salient one for you right now? And life circumstances trumps everything. And life circumstances includes housing, problems with the legal system, and a variety of illnesses. So it puts their illness, as Susan was suggesting, in a broader context of what they're struggling with.
As well as that trauma-informed intervention before you give the warm referral. So really talking about that medication adherence in a trauma-informed way if there is a disclosure. If anybody's interested, we have some new resources and tools to help train providers on that approach. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.